This is Dr. Miller. Happy to be here with you here today. And we're going to be looking more deeply into what I call the new paradigm thinking. Upgrade your mental software. Defeat the media propaganda and access the higher levels of your mind. In other words, change your mind and change your life. Well, I'd like to welcome you all and thank you for being here today. I want to thank you for your donations. It's been very, very kind of you to offer me those donations. I want to begin with a question. And my question is, why? It's a question that I ask myself as a high school student. Why is it that we, this brilliant race of beings, screwing up so badly? Now, I want you to know this is back in 1957, 1958, so things weren't nearly as bad as they are now. And it's basically taken me a lifetime of research and practice to find an answer and a remedy to these problems. And remarkably, even though I started out in medicine and discovered how to heal individuals, it turns out that the way you heal a personal illness or dysfunction is the same way that we can operate at the collective level. It's the most effective way I have found yet that has the possibility to transform the whole system. So my work now is to share it with as many people as possible. So if you like what you see, click like, send messages to your friends to log on. Go to drmiller.com, and it'll show them exactly how to log on. And in earlier sessions around our new paradigm, we've talked about how we can communicate with and alter the programming of the monkey mind, that unconscious part of our brain, and how we can rewire the nervous system. Today, I want to focus on the specific kind of programming, the kind of algorithm, the kind of paradigm that it's most valuable to program into our nervous systems. I talk about programming because I was a computer programmer back in the early 60s, learned how computers worked, which gave me a big leg up when I went to medical school and went to psychiatry. And I said, the brain works in a way exactly analogous to a computer, except that we have two different brains, one we're conscious of and the other that we're unconscious of. And I gradually began to realize that the unconscious part of our brain was excellently adapted to the world we lived in 200,000 to 300,000 years ago. But the world that we live in has changed so dramatically because we live in cultures and we're surrounded by all kinds of different experiences and information. But our brain has not evolved at all. Yeah, certainly not in the last 50,000 years. Consider what the world was like back then. And as a result, we keep making terrible mistakes in our thinking. And so my work has been to discover how we can correct those mistakes. And it involves, as you know, using certain tools such as mindfulness, meditation, selective awareness, mental image rehearsal, guided imagery, and so forth, so that we can bring the conscious and the unconscious minds into harmony around the goals, visions, and objectives that we have at the highest levels of our mind and our awareness. So I'm going to begin by kind of reviewing some of the things we've been over, particularly for those who might not have been here for the earlier sessions. They can go back and go to drmiller.com, Watch Life Meditations, and you can see the earlier ones. What Albert Einstein said about imagination, I want to focus on that for a moment, because essential to your understanding and acquiring the ability to use the healing techniques I'm sharing with you today is that you give yourself permission to open up and to have the experience that I'm inviting you to have. I can't make you see or feel anything. You can look out the window or you can pay attention. I'm telling you, it's really, really worthwhile. And if you pay attention, you can have the experience and feel what it is that you are imagining as you look at the different images and so forth, or that you see on your screen, or that you create in your mind. Let yourself feel those. And we practiced before thinking about a lemon, and by doing so, cause ourselves to salivate, which is something that is not available for you to create consciously. You can't just salivate on will, but if you think about a lemon, you can do it. We also talked about speeding up your heart and raising your blood pressure, which you could do, but only by using your imagination of standing on the edge of the roof. Now we're going to be dealing with a little bit more complex items, but it works in exactly the same way. So right now, allow your body to be in a comfortable position. Become aware of the fact that there's no other place that you need to go, nothing else that you need to do, and there's no problem that you have to solve. And the reason I say that is when you repeat it to yourself, you're telling the monkey mind, there's no danger, dude. You're all right. You can relax. And you can turn off the stress reaction. Turn off the adrenaline, turn off the hydrocortisone, turn off the cytokines, turn off all of those chemicals, and allow yourself to relax so you can be in the present. And allow yourself here in this present to be exactly the person that you are. And imagine that at this moment in time, you are exactly the person that you're supposed to be. And that right now, you are in exactly the place that you're supposed to be in. Take a deep breath in. As you let it out, think to yourself the words, it breathes me. And allow the air to do the breathing. And then with each breath out, it breathes me. You sink into the pause. And feel relaxation and peace be breathed in with the next breath in, letting go and sinking into that pause, relaxing more and more deeply. Imagine relaxation flowing over your body as if you're standing beneath a soothing shower of relaxation, flowing into your body, relaxing your scalp and your head, your face. Muscles around your mouth relax, your shoulders and arms and wrists and hands. Relaxation flowing in with each breath, filling your chest with relaxation. And with each breath out, that relaxation flows down into your abdomen, relaxing all your internal organs and allowing that relaxation to flow through your pelvis and your thighs, your knees, your legs, and your ankles, all the way down to the tips of your toes. And anytime any unnecessary thoughts come along, with your next breath out, imagine you're breathing those unnecessary thoughts out of your mind. Allowing yourself to be here in the present, knowing that the past is gone forever and can't come back, not even one second of it. And so you don't need to be concerned with it. And that makes it possible for you to have more of your brain, more of your RAM, if you will, available for you to focus where you want to focus it. Imagine you're kind of within a sphere, a perfect sphere, an invisible sphere, but it's an energy shield, and it blocks all negative energy from coming in, blocks all unnecessary thoughts about the past or the future because they don't really exist. And just be with your breathing, be at peace. And if you'd like to, you can go to your special place, that safe place, that sacred place that you go to be totally at peace, totally calm. And think to yourself the words, this present moment is absolutely perfect. There's nothing missing. There's nothing extra. And so I can allow myself to be completely at peace. Good. And imagine that you can feel yourself in touch with a vast reservoir of relaxation that you can tap into and remain calm and relaxed. protected by this sphere so that you can go ahead and imagine the things that I talk about and be at peace. Even if some of the things are a little disturbing, you remain relaxed so that you can look more deeply, remembering that the unconscious part of our mind causes our thoughts to veer away from the truth. If your monkey mind thinks it's going to upset you, then it uses what's called denial to prevent you from seeing that truth, and instead shifts you over to something else that's more comfortable. You know, like a drink of beer or a feeling of anger or suspicion or escape or whatever, anything that's better than looking at some of these truths that we really need to look at. But you can remain relaxed, in touch with this reservoir of relaxation. I want to travel back a ways through time with you, because I want to look at that principle of love that I talk about. That once the world was very unfriendly, there was no life. There are a lot of polar, bipolar compounds around, making unstable connections with each other. And then one day, along comes the carbon atom with a very different idea. Instead of one atom taking an electron from the other, the two carbons would share an electron. They would share an electron. This notion of sharing made so many things possible. And I call that the urge to merge, instead of that give and take. Yeah, it's that kind of greedy way of doing things. And that urge to merge made it possible for us to create huge molecules then, consisting of dozens and hundreds of different atoms. And therefore, we're able to create something called proteins. We're able to create something called desoxyribonucleic acid. In other words, the DNA that made it possible for life to exist. And at one point, some group of chemicals wrapped a cell around themselves and created, or wrapped a membrane around themselves and called themselves a cell. And it was the living cell. To remain alive, that membrane had to remain intact. If the cell membrane is ruptured, it must be repaired quickly. That's what we call healing. So healing is the process of maintaining wholeness. It means differentiating yourself from the external world. That is to have effective boundaries. And thirdly, to maintain and restore balance within the cell, and balance in relationship to the environment. That first cell also had the ability to reproduce itself, making a perfect copy. But pretty soon, some of the daughter cells decided, let's not separate, let's stay together. And suddenly they began to create multicellular animals that were capable of so much more than these little isolated cells. Once again, the urge to merge saved life and made it possible to create even more complex animals, larger animals. And whatever kind of animal it was, that animal's functions were held together through a nervous system, a central nervous system, what we call the brain, and then the peripheral nervous system that carries the brain's information out into the rest of the body. Without those nerves and without that brain, we couldn't have made it. And so that nervous system and brain are essential to and a critical piece of the wholeness of the urge to merge. And that urge to merge created something called sexual reproduction. It's a special kind of merging. And the results of that was the creation of the family. And just feel the energy that holds us together with our children, our dogs, with our cats, or the mama bear, with her cub. That's a powerful force. Can you feel it? Can you feel that force that holds together families? in the harshest of conditions, the closeness that's there. And it made it possible as civilization developed for larger groups of us to get together and feel the bond that holds us together, that urge to merge. Flocks of birds that fly together and support each other. The herds of animals on the surface of the earth. And so part of that urge to merge is what is called a herd instinct, which is the tendency to want to give up one's individual freedom to a certain degree and to follow, to be a part of that group and serve the group. And that works really well. Take a look at the wildebeest who have to migrate all the way across Africa twice a year, and they have to remember where to go and how to handle everything. But the group knows. I don't know that an individual can. So there's group knowledge, this group intelligence. And in human beings, that urge to merge also creates collective wisdom. Now, instead of saying the urge to merge, I call it love with a capital L. And by love with a capital L, I don't mean the same thing maybe as the Beatles meant, or hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name, but something deeper. Shared values, integration, inclusiveness, a both and way of looking at the world, a sense of caring, and even intimacy. And there's balance, harmony, empathy, compassion, wholeness, coherence. You get a feeling of what I mean by love with a capital L. You might think of that as being a love algorithm, which is an algorithm, is a process or a set of rules to be followed in calculations or in problem-solving operations, especially by a computer or a biocomputer, as I call the brain. So if you want to divide 25 into 166, you can do that by using an algorithm called long division or short division. So algorithms are simply processes or rules in how we interpret the world, how we process it. And we're talking about that feeling of love, or it's a very particular kind of love, is that love that draws us together, a man and a woman, let's say, who become mates and who become lovers, and it's not work. What's that force? It's an incredible force. Used wisely, wonderful things can happen. When it's not used wisely, it can lead people to create and perpetrate some of the most heinous crimes, all the way from street corner hoodlums up to priests in the biggest church in the world, if you don't know how to handle that urge to merge. But then there's that experience of pregnancy, and what women feel in pregnancy and a loving father will feel also during pregnancy, or to have that baby, to nurse that baby. Can you feel the love? And that's what I'm talking about. There is that power, that urge to merge. It appears in many different ways. As time passed for the life force, there arose what I call the dark force. We had lots of capital L love, and that's what made life possible. But then at a certain point, so what happened was the life force realized that instead of manufacturing everything from dissolved chemicals in the fluids around us, we could just eat the bodies of other animals and have the proteins and the molecules already created, a much more efficient way of doing things than absorbing things through your root. And you think of that salmon has traveled so many miles upstream, and this is what happens to him. A bear gets to eat him, but bear's got to put on muscle and it's got to feed her and his kids. So we talked about it at the personal level, but then we also have it at the social and collective level, at the level of our community. And we see racism, sexism, supremacy thinking, homophobia, nationalism, anti-Semitism, elitism, xenophobia, ableism, ageism. And when we compare the conflict or violence, dark force versus the light force, love, conflict is binary. Love is continuous. Conflict is either or. Love is both and. Conflict is reductionism versus holism. Debate versus dialogue. It's a fixed mindset. Me good, you bad. Versus a growth mindset. Let's see who we are together. Fragmentation versus organization. Specialization versus generalization. Accommodation versus assimilation. Opposition versus acceptance. Black and white versus a spectrum. Defensive versus the creative. Now you get a feeling of these two different algorithms, two different ways to approach the world. And the old paradigm, in other words, the way our monkey mind leads us to think about the world, focuses the attention primarily, if not exclusively, on the use of that violence conflict algorithm. Mm-hmm. So the moment you see somebody who has a different color skin or speaks with a different accent, or maybe they're a different gender, whatever it might be, then you figure, uh-oh, you know, I don't like this person. They speak funny. Their breath smells funny. What do they eat? Right? And so you tend to reject them. And very often in your culture, you've been trained to reject them. And that is the way we approach life. And that's why that's how we create so many illnesses within ourselves. And what it is that we want to do is to shift to the new paradigm. And the new paradigm isn't just the love algorithm, but it is a combination of the two. It doesn't reject that analytic way of looking at things. It adds to it that way of looking at things to say, what can we do together? And I would say to begin, when you're dealing with a situation, unless there's something that's clear that this situation is truly a threat to your life or limb within the next couple of minutes, in which case, get out of Dodge. But if it's not, then start with the capital L algorithm and seek to see if there's a connection. Now, so how we look at the world, our paradigms define how we perceive reality and how we behave within that perception. A paradigm is a way of organizing and condensing sensory information. And it's a way of creating balance. It's like in the yin yang, you have the black and the white. But the idea behind the yin yang and behind Taoism is they appear to be opposites, but they're not. In fact, that little white dot in the middle of the black says that in everything is the seed of its apparent opposite. So black and white aren't opposites, they're two essential parts of a whole. And what the practitioner of Taoism looks for is what's called the middle way. That's kind of like that cycle of a line between the black and the white. That's where the fullness is. Lao Tzu, a well-known practitioner thereof, said, if you want to awaken all of humanity, then awaken all of yourself. If you want to eliminate the suffering in the world and eliminate all that is dark and negative, then eliminate all that is dark and negative in yourself. Truly, the greatest gift you have to give is that of your own self-transformation. Now, I talked before about how we have in our world been hijacked by the system that we live in, how our thinking and our lives have been hijacked, leaving us feeling helpless and disempowered. That leaves us being polarized and incapable of joining hands and minds with those that we need to join with. And then we can solve the big problems we will confront. Take a look at the, you know, incredibly dysfunctional Congress of the United States right now. How did we get, what happened to E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, the ability to join together in a positive way? Instead, it's this movement toward fascism. Remember these? You see lines going from left to right. Are they parallel or not? They look not parallel, but if you can get a ruler and measure it, they're totally parallel. Yet your brain is telling you that it's different, you know? Or if you read this quickly out loud and then go back and proofread it, you find out, no, you didn't read it correctly, but you didn't know you were doing it incorrectly because, again, your unconscious mind already interpreted it for you. When you stand figures of a person alongside of a wall where the lines move in a certain way, say we have three men here, which one is the tallest? Is one taller than the other? Or how does it work? Well, of course, they're all exactly the same. I just cut out one of the guys down below and moved them up here so you can see it. And yet your brain is telling you something different. And that's because the unconscious part of your mind has learned to interpret the world in a certain way. And the way it's learned to interpret the world is in a way that has made life work in the past. But if you're in a different kind of environment, that way of interpreting the world can get you in big trouble. There's one of my favorite old stories is about the donkey, and every day the master would load the donkey up with the salt and then make the donkey carry the salt for 8 or 10 hours across country, and they'd empty the salt and he'd come home. One day as they're walking along they're crossing a stream and the donkey slipped and fell over on its back in the stream. And by the time I was able to get up again, well, the salt had all dissolved. And, oh, he felt great. So he finished out the walk and came home the next day. They were out with another load of salt. When he got to the stream, he flipped over and wallowed around on his back a little bit and got up. Yeah, yeah, I like this. Yeah. But the master figured out what the donkey was doing. So the next day he loaded him up with sponges. Ooh, ooh. Oh, not good, not good. Because what the monkey had learned was useful and valuable at a certain point, but at a certain point, it wasn't useful anymore. And so what's happened is that the world and people have learned how to use our unconscious minds against us or in ways that we're not aware of. I want to talk a little bit about this fellow, Edward Bernays. I don't know if you know about him, but you know, if I was to ask you, what's the quintessential breakfast? You go into a diner. What do you order for breakfast? 50% of the time, what do you order? Bacon and eggs, of course. Well, it hasn't always been that way. It wasn't that way in back in the beginning of the last century. People would just have a little fruit juice, maybe piece of fruit, maybe a little bit of cereal or something like that. But the Hormel's ham company wanted to sell more ham. And so they happened to find Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays is a nephew of Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud, as we have discussed, introduced us to the concept of the unconscious mind and how the unconscious mind is extremely important in making the decisions that we think we're making. And we're very helpless in the face of that unconscious mind. And of course, Freud was talking about people who were pretty disturbed mentally, otherwise they wouldn't be going to a psychiatrist in the 1800s. Bernays figured out how to put this information to work by how you can influence this subconscious part of the mind, the monkey mind. So Hormel hired him, and what he did was he sent out letters to lots and lots of different physicians, and he said, because of the kind of work that people have to do all day, do you feel it's advisable to have, you know, a heavy breakfast? He sent that out to 5,000 people, and I think 3,000 answered of them, and a lot of them, 2,000, whatever it was, I'm not sure of the numbers, said, yes, that sounded like a good idea to me. So he created an ad, Bernays did, saying 2,000 doctors agree eating a heavy breakfast is a good idea. And when it comes to a heavy breakfast, that's hard to beat, bacon and eggs. And sure enough, everybody started eating bacon and eggs. And the sale of bacon went up considerably, you know, much to the happiness of Hormel Company. Then Lucky Strike got hold of him and said, you know, we're having a real problem because women won't smoke in public. They'll smoke, you know, behind the scenes and hide the fact that they smoke, but it'd be very embarrassing for a woman to smoke in public. And if women could smoke in public, we could make lots and lots more money. And, you know, the lung surgeons could make lots and lots. No, they didn't really say that. That was a joke. Sorry. So what Bernays did was he hired a bunch of models, sort of high class looking women, and he hired them to be there to walk in front of the Easter parade one particular year. But before the parade, he sent letters to many different reporters and photographers and said, at the corner of Fifth Avenue and whatever street it was, on Easter Sunday at, you know, 8 a.m., there's going to be a very important event. So these guys all showed up to scoop the story. And so who comes along with these well-dressed ladies? And at a certain signal, they whip out their cigarettes and light them up and flash them as they're walking in front of the parade. And they called them freedom torches. And sure enough, before long, women were learning how to enjoy smoking and even inhaling. We had ads to kind of teach them, do you inhale? Everybody's doing it now. Of course, sales of Lucky Strike went through the roof. There's a movie that you can watch on YouTube. It's called The Century of the Self. It doesn't cost you anything to watch it. It blew my mind when I watched it. It's all about Bernays and the things that he did and was able to convince people to do by manipulating their subconscious minds. Up until this period of time, when people bought merchandise, they bought things that they needed. You know, you have a flat tire, so you buy another tire. So you bought things because you needed it. You needed milk, so you bought milk. But from this era on, people were being trained to buy things because they want them, not because they need them. Bernays went on to work with presidents. Woodrow Wilson didn't want to go to war in the First World War, but J.P. Morgan had invested a lot in arming France and England against Germany, but France and England weren't doing that well, and J.P. Morgan didn't really have an unlimited supply of money, certainly not as much as the United States government, so he went to Wilson and said, you got to enter the war. I don't want to lose all this money. Wilson was quite against the war. You know? So Wilson said, oh, I don't know. How am I going to change things? So he hired Bernays. So now he changed the idea, Bernays, to we weren't going to to fight the war, but we were going over to make the world safe for democracy. And people really got behind that idea that we would make the world safe for democracy. And you know, the rest, we did everything that we did. And he went ahead and worked with every president, I believe, up until Eisenhower. And what he called propaganda is the executive arm of the government. He wrote a book called Propaganda, the Public Mind in the Making. That's our propaganda, a form of communication aimed at influencing beliefs and attitudes towards some cause or position. This information is not impartial. Its goal is to influence through selectively presenting facts and lying, and thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods, like 2,000 doctors think you should eat bacon and eggs for breakfast, you know, when that might be quite a minority of who's out there, but they don't tell you that part of it. And you leave thinking you've bought that big lie. And that big lie is kept alive by propaganda. And of course, who read his book on propaganda? You got it. Joseph Goebbels, who was the head of the Ministry of Propaganda of the Nazi regime. He said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. And, you know, take a look at the political party that you like the least right now and look at the big lie they're telling. But the Nazis were able to make very good use of it to basically hypnotize the German people. And that's the same thing that's happening these days, except big corporations and other groups of people are doing it. Foreign countries are doing it now using the internet. You know, that's wonderful. They're able to really, you know, shift our elections. You want to know how that's done? This is a fascinating book. It's called Mind, the Cambridge Analytics and the Plot to Break America. Cambridge Analytics. Start out by flipping elections in the West Indies. Then they went ahead to make people believe in Brexit. And then they went to screw around with our election of 2016. And the guy who did it, who was at the center of it, was Christopher Wiley, W-Y-L-I-E. And he suddenly realized what a terrible thing he was involved in doing. And then he wrote this book, which is an excellent book. It's a good read, but it tells you, if you don't know, if you haven't looked at it in detail, but to really understand how data mining can give malefactors the ability to change everybody's mind. You know, when you want to make a political change, you examine people's behaviors, you figure out who has high anxiety, who is fearful of invasion, and then you create a fake group and send emails inviting people to join this fake group, promising that they're going to find what they need. They join it, and you keep feeding them negative stories. They get more and more worked up. And then you give them ways to invite their friends, and they find other people who have fear of foreigners and fear of integration and so forth like that. And soon you've got a mass of people, and you can actually affect the way the votes come about. Next, I want to focus on the work of Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. He wrote this book called Thinking Fast and Slow. He won his Nobel Prize back around the turn of the century, you know, 2001 or two, something like that, or the end of the 90s. Well, His work has been phenomenal for me and my thinking. It's brought me up to a whole other level of understanding what makes people sick, what makes them unhappy, what makes them fail. And I'll give you an idea. And well, his up until this point, the field of economics, which is his field, believed that people made the best choice that was available to them when they purchased things. And economic theory was based on that. But what he showed was that's not true, that people are affected by things that are not in the slightest in their best interest. And these are some of the kinds of experiments that he did to reveal what's going on. In one experiment, people come in to be a part of a psychological experiment. The experimenter walks into the room where the subject is sitting and hands them a cup of coffee. So, would you hold this coffee for me while I put all these books in? He's got a load of books and he puts on the desk, and then he takes the cup of coffee back from the subject. And then he goes on with, it really doesn't matter what, maybe gives a little quiz or a test or send them on their way. But the important thing is, as they're on their way out, there's a person who asks some question at the desk on the way out and said, how did you like the experiment? Good. And by the way, did you notice the experimenter, did he have a warm personality, would you say, or a cool personality? Well, if the person was given a warm cup of coffee, they thought he had a warm personality. If they were given a cup of iced coffee, they thought he had a cool personality. Not 100%, but to a large degree, people were affected in that way. They took a group of experienced judges, and they said, we want you to make a ruling on a certain case, but before we do that, I want you to throw these dice. It's just part of the experiment. So the judge throws the dice, and they write down the number and put the dice away and never say any more about it. And they then give the judge a case, and they give him 15 minutes to read the case of a shoplifter. She's been arrested. She's been arrested, but let go with a warning twice before. Now she's done it a third time. So, of course, she needs to spend some time in jail. But how much time in jail? Well, what the judges don't know is that the dice were loaded and that they were going to come up either. They're going to come up 2 or they're going to come up 11. When the dice come up 2, the judge was given an average of 4 months incarceration for the offender. When they come up 11, they give 7 or 8 months. And this has been repeated again and again. Of course, you ask the judge, did that? what am I saying? I'm saying that we are neurotic, because that's the way we are. We get angry about things when it doesn't help us to be angry. We get anxious when it doesn't help us. We get anxious before we give a talk. It doesn't help us. Why are we getting anxious? You know, we get afraid of things that are, we generate life or death fear when there's nothing to be afraid of. And that's what causes all of our habits, bad habits, our escape behaviors, our addictions, because the monkey mind is feeling fear or pain and it wants to get away. So it turns to those habits. So that is to say, what Freud called us is the normal neurotics, that we all have neurotic behavior. And that behavior, where we're having feelings that don't serve us, when we have behaviors that don't serve us, you know, it's like that, you know, you get bad news on the phone, really bad news, and you're really furious. You, what? You're letting me down. I feel so betrayed. We take that phone and take that $1,500 phone and throw it as far as we can into that brick wall, shattering it. And then we go, man, what I just did to my phone. The things that we say, the names that we'll call people. In other words, the things that we say and that we do that don't serve us in our lives, this is what's going on.
is that unconscious part of the brain is triggering those behaviors. At its root, all neurotic behavior, automatic unconscious effort to manage a deep anxiety. And neurotic behavior is characterized by anxiety, negativity, self-doubt, continually rehashing worst case scenarios in your head, guilt, worry, fear, depression. So those are the kinds of things. And sometimes when we think about those, we can think about somebody who's very ill and whose life is falling apart because they're so extreme. But for just about all of us, we have life patterns that aren't serving us, how we eat, how we drink, how we relate with people. And what's happening is that this unconscious part of the mind is affecting us. And why is it doing that? It's doing that because we have been abused. We have not had an environment that's really appropriate for child rearing. We all have been traumatized and abused. That's why we do stupid things. People who have a loving mother who's there constantly knows exactly how to raise that child. They're protected from having to deal with bullies in school until they're old enough to really learn how to healthily deal with it. They're not called names. They're not criticized. You're not says, "Why are you crying? Be a man. Don't cry." On and on and on. Those things destroy our soul and make it impossible for us to be who we are. We end up making mistakes based upon defensive behaviors coming from the unconscious. Let's take just a little while and talk about another way of looking at things. An old saying, the young donkey complains about the length of his ears. The old horse thanks God for grass. It's like the blind man and the elephant. They jump to a conclusion, whereas if they could step back and see the whole picture, that's what we need to be able to do. And that's one of the reasons we use the meditation. We use the deep relaxation. Once we're in that place of relaxation and presence, then we can access our wisdom, make the wise choice, and follow it through. And what we're going to do today, to link it to what we began with, we're talking about making the loving choice, the one that brings us together. Or as God commanded in the Old Testament, if you read that kind of a book, love one another as I have loved you. Or as written in 1 Peter 4:8, above all, keep loving one another earnestly, deeply, since love covers a multitude of sins. In other words, creates forgiveness. Or as Jesus said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Saint Augustine said, to have faith is to believe in what you do not see. And the reward of faith is to see that in which you have believed. Someone said to Mother Teresa, how can you take care of the sickest of the sick and the poorest of the poor? So many die every day in your little clinics. Don't you get depressed? And she said, depressed? She says, I look into their eyes and I see Jesus. How could I be depressed? When I heard that, I said, I want what she's having. If you can do that, well, you can do that. And I learned that I could do that in my work, and it enabled me that when people came to see me, no matter what terrible shape they were in, physically, mentally, emotionally, I looked and saw the healthy person they could be. I visualized to the best of my ability after meeting with them for a little while. I could see little ways that they smiled, little ways that they moved, little ways that they reacted to things that spoke of a caring and loving human being that was capable of health and happiness. And then my work is just to get rid of the dirt that was on the surface, just to cleanse it away, cleanse away those kinds of thoughts and behaviors that were leading them to make unwise decisions. Remember, every little decision that you make can change the trajectory of your life. So choose wisely. You've been trained to feel helpless. And I'll talk more about this next time, because I want to go more into specifically how the system teaches us to have learned helplessness in order to control us. But as Martin Luther King said, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. There are only two ways to live your life. This is an Einstein quote. Only two ways to live your life. One as though nothing is a miracle. The other as though everything is a miracle. And I'm giving you these quotes because they're revealing ways of looking at the world. You may have heard people say, no, you don't need to worry. You know, it's all in God's hands. God has a plan. Well, you can argue with that, particularly if you turn on the news about Ukraine or whatever, but that doesn't stop them from believing that's true. And that belief itself creates a very different way of living your life. So let's use our imaginations for a few moments and pretend that everything that has happened up until this very instant in time was planned by some supreme being, that it had been written, that everything had to happen exactly the way it did in the past. So there's no use criticizing what happened, no use judging yourself, no use labeling things as good or bad, no need to feel ashamed or guilty or resentful about things, no reason to think badly about something that happened last week, whether it was a mistake, or to think it was wrong, some ruling by the Supreme Court, anything. It all had to happen that way. Just imagine that you can imagine that that's true, that everything's exactly the way it's supposed to be. The kind of thinking that then arises as you realize you don't want things to stay this way, that's for sure. Just because they were meant to be this way at this moment. Well, then now you're focused upon how can you change things for the future? So you're not stuck feeling ashamed or guilty or resentful or angry and all of those things that, remember, when you have life or death kinds of feelings like that, that's what they are, negative emotion, it turns off your higher mind. So you cannot find the creative solution to what's going on. So therefore, you usually do a poor job of solving the problem. So now you can solve things the way you really want to. So it makes sense to accept the past just the way it is. Or as the Buddha said, the source of all suffering is wanting things to be different from how they are. At this moment, they can't be any different. It's illogical. It's like saying, I want that tree over there to be a candy bar. I'm going to get upset because that tree is not a candy bar. Why should I waste my thoughts on that? So that's what we want to do, is shift to thinking things according to that new paradigm. So let's finish off with a little bit of imagery once again. Allow your body to be in a comfortable place. Good. And then you can add to that other thoughts, such as, I am part of the whole. There's a spiritual oneness that I share with others. There's a part of you that is light and beautiful and sacred. And there's a part of me that is light and beautiful and sacred. And when you're in that place, and you and I'm in that place, and me, there's only one of us. That's what's called namaste. I choose to think positively about people. Unless there's a very good reason about how a positive outcome is going to take place, I strictly avoid thinking negative thoughts about people. I choose to release judgmentalism. I have no need to criticize others unless I am sincerely asked to do so. Every cloud really does have a silver lining. I have a great power within. It is the power to relax. When I relax and come into the present moment, I am freed from habitual ways of acting and thinking. In this place of relaxation, I can access the wisdom within me and the spirit that I wish to guide my choices. My life is filled with wonderful gifts, beauty, and love. Now take a few moments and allow yourself to feel gratitude and think about some of those incredible things that you have you can feel gratitude about. And again, let yourself really feel it. And let yourself know that anytime that you're feeling upset, angry, anxious, cheated, left out, etc., come into your present moment and simply become aware of all the things that are there for you to be grateful for. The day, this breath, the ability to see, the ability to speak, the ability to hear or sing or walk or love or be loved. I can be grateful for my cell phone and grateful for the fact that it has a button that I can turn it off. And when you're ready, go ahead and guide yourself back to being fully wide awake, feeling comfortable, free. You want to follow up on some of the things that we've talked about. The movie, Live Life. Go to drmiller.com/livelife. The love meditation available at drmiller.com. Rainbow Butterfly, the beautiful harp of Georgia Kelly, and a fantastic meditation. Program called The Power of Your Mind to Nurture Your Spirit, which is a DVD. My book, Our Culture on the Couch. My most popular book, Deep Healing, written back in the 90s. The Essence of Mind-Body Medicine. Healing Our Planet. It's a wonderful meditation that you can enjoy. It's been so wonderful to have you here with me. Look forward to seeing you again in 4 weeks. And I want to go a little more deeply into how to transform into that new paradigm, the one that I found was so healing for the people that I treat and that I coach. Till then,